We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm joined by my colleague, David Harsanyi, senior editor at the Federalist, author of many books, the most recent of which is called Eurotrash and is well worth a read. David, thanks for joining us.
It is my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Now, people might be wondering, David Harsanyi, didn't he leave? And we are so lucky because David Harsanyi has returned. The prodigal son has returned. So, David, you have, I looked at your most recent articles, and the last one you wrote was about, I think it was about Star Wars. It was The Fall of Skywalker from October 22nd, 2019. And your penultimate one was called Whatever You Do, Don't Send Your Kids to J School. Which October of 2019 was right on the cusp of COVID and the world changed in a very dramatic way shortly after your departure. But now you're back and your first article back is Biden promises to transition America back to the 1870s. Some people might be thinking of the 1970s as a parallel, but David, you say it's the 1870s. Why is that?
Because I think, though I have to admit I did not research this, I think that's when the first combustion engine was built, but I'm not sure. It's somewhere around there. So it just sounded right. It's all about what sounds right.
Well, so what is the salience of the first combustion engine in the context of your argument?
Well, there's this argument that we've been sort of browbeaten into and fear-mongered into, that, you know, we have to transition off of fossil fuels. Now, I'm actually pro-fossil fuels. So when people say, like, you know, we need all of the above or whatever, I'm against that. Like, I think fossil fuels are great. I think that we're learning how we have new efficiencies that make it even better. And the alternatives aren't very good right now. So in essence, well, Joe Biden, I should take a step back and say that Joe Biden yesterday, I think it was, said we're going to, you know, high gas prices means we're going through this incredible transition to where, you know, we'll be stronger and less reliant on fossil fuels, et cetera, which is a weird thing to say politically speaking, considering how much people are suffering. But it's also a weird thing to say from 30,000 feet and, you know, as far as society goes, because this is a transition that it hasn't been working at all. And will only mean more poverty around the world and more pain for the American people. So that's gist of it.
Well, it's odd to me because we're talking about Joe Biden, who was supposedly the centrist king returning to, he was supposed to return America to normalcy and was supposed to be moderate. And obviously at the Federalist and, all kinds of places, it was brought to the public's attention that such a promise would never be fulfilled because Joe Biden in 2020 and 2022 is not capable of governing in any sort of moderate or centrist way. But the energy policies of Joe Biden are kind of confounding because there are all sorts of, like, even all things even, like, corporate interests, establishment Democrats are generally really responsive to. But what do you think it is that has Joe Biden, even Joe Biden, being so wedded to, as you say, an agenda and an argument that has failed in real time over the course of, you know, recent years?
Well, I think people mistook sort of lack of principles of Joe Biden as moderation. He is essentially is always wherever the sort of center left Democratic Party is. And now that center left is just radical, right? And at least from my perspective. So that's where he is. And it seems like Twitter is sort of a Twitter consensus on the left is governing America, basically. But maybe it's Ron Klain. I don't know. But so I'm not that surprised by his position on energy, but I wouldn't say it's anti-corporate in the sense that obviously oil companies want to make more oil, but there are a lot of big car companies that have made and other sort of industries that have made huge bets on alternative energy, et cetera. And there are mandates and states and nationally where they've sort of set their strategy moving forward. And risk assessments and so forth, you know, all around climate change. So that's A. B, I don't think anyone actually takes him very seriously. So, he's done many things that are sort of embedded. You know, we talk about the price and, you know, of gas and how terrible it is. And then people will tell you, well, you know, Keystone would have done anything, more drilling would have done anything, but all of that's baked into the price. I mean, people look at what the future looks like of oil production, and then that, and that has something to do with the price as well. It's a fungible commodity. It's not all Joe Biden's fault. Obviously, there are a lot of things going on in the world, but it is partly his fault. I mean, you know, a lot of the things that he's done are meant, I should mention this too, because it's the crux of my article and I forgot to mention it, but, you know, I want to just talk about how, you know, the point of almost any climate legislation since cap and trade, or even before, has been to make gas and energy more expensive, fossil fuel energy more expensive. So I always wonder why reporters don't ask these Democrats, isn't this what you wanted? Wasn't this the point of cap and trade? Wasn't this the point of the Green New Deal, to create scarcity, to make you know, fossil fuels more expensive? This is what you want. So maybe Joe Biden's just being honest about that transition that he wants us to be a part of.
Yeah, and that's, you start your piece with this quote from Joe Biden, where he's saying this on Monday: we're going through an incredible transition that is taking place that, God willing, when it's over, we'll be stronger and the world will be stronger and less reliant on fossil fuels when this is over. So a couple of things you just said were really interesting to me. One is that the country is basically being governed by leftist Twitter. And secondly, that there are special interests on the other side of this question. For all the left likes to howl about the fossil fuel industry and ExxonMobil, well, there are special interests on the other side of these questions, in addition to like Exxon even getting into like green energy spaces and all of that stuff. Right. So what, like Joe Biden saying that we're going through an incredible transition is so interesting. It won't be one thing during the campaign in 2020. It's an entirely different thing when the country is just like being absolutely smacked with this level of inflation. So I'm curious as to what you think, like what it says about Joe Biden, about the Democratic Party and about the country, that even right now, when they could bring prices down with different policies, they're still sticking to this line that the transition is worth the pain at the pump.
That's a good question. I'm not sure what they're thinking in the White House. I mean, obviously there's a, well, you know, there's a faction of apparently very important one that is very ideological. And in this question, obviously many of the special interests and many of the big donors and many of the, you know, progressives you need in the party are very concerned about climate change. I think Democrats fool themselves, as they do with many issues, where they'll look at a poll, right? And you ask people, like, do you want to fight climate change? Everyone's like, yeah, hell yeah, I want to fight climate change. It's like number 19 on the list. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you ask those same people, are you willing to pay $6 or $5 a gallon to fight climate change, and see what they say, you know? So I'm not sure it's as clear, in, you know, as they think, or as simple as they think. So, but to them, the most important faction is the progressive one in many ways, it seems. I mean, we see it on abortion and sort of the radicalism there. Like Chuck Schumer could have put forward a more moderate bill that protected, you know, the right to an abortion, but he didn't. You know, he gave in. And it seems like it's always the maximalist position these days. And maybe that happens on the right as well. I don't know. But I happen to think that their positions are more extreme when it comes to things that actually will you know, that people care about. Inflation is not something, you know, it's not a culture issue in the sense that, you know, people might care about, let's say, gay marriage or trans issues, but inflation is something that they're forced to care about, even if they don't care, you know, pay attention to politics. So especially energy prices, which are embedded in literally everything that has to do with the economy.
Well, this like raises the, also, this is such a good parallel to their idiocy on nuclear energy, that like it's this, they're wedded to such an ideological stance that even obvious kind of solutions to it fall by the wayside and are attacked as evil. It also seems like, I mean, this has happened in California on a different scale, but it just seems like our energy policy has been so bungled that we were in a way more fragile, I guess, ecosystem, no like pun intended there, but in a way more fragile economic ecosystem when the sort of global crises came to pass. We get it, David. You're a busy, popular man.
Or more like a boomer who doesn't know how to turn these things off. And it's just like, yeah.
So good.
Yeah. So you're saying, like, you know, so we're not prepared for a war in Ukraine, you know, or we're not prepared for those things. Yeah, we're not. Listen, there's only so much you can do. Again, I mean, oil is you know, it's fungible. So if Russia turns it off, or Saudi Arabia doesn't, you know, decreases production or doesn't up it, you know, it's going to hurt us. But we could, there is no real thing. You know, I know people like to say energy independence. I don't think that that really exists. However, we could do a lot to bring down prices by being prepared to produce more. And we can flood the world, right, with oil. We can do those things here. And it's not always cost efficient for companies to do it. I understand that as well. But, you know, setting that all that aside, Biden and Democrats in general have literally, I mean, I don't want to go through all of it, but literally on the first day of his presidency, he signed, like, I think it's 6 executive orders undermining fossil fuel production in this country. There's so much land run by the feds where there's oil that they essentially, you know, they're a big part of that industry, and they have just cut it off. So, you know, the stuff that people get excited about, like solar energy, it's such a small part of our portfolio. I don't even know if people realize that, like, I think it's like 12% of our energy comes from renewables, and that's like, or clean energy. And that's like, after decades of mandates and huge subsidies. And of that 12%, only 11% is solar, right? And, you know, the big ones like geothermal or hydroelectric or others outside of that, like nuclear, are not of interest to environmentalists for some reason. So even if I wanted to make the world less reliant on fossil fuels, they simply will not embrace any of the things that could, you know, actually make a dent in for that cause. And they simply won't do it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I guess it just raises the question again of why, if we just stick with the nuclear question, like geothermal is sort of different, but if we stick with the nuclear question, why do you think it is that, I mean, people like Michael Schellenberger seem to be like maybe moving the Overton window for the left, maybe not, but why is it that on nuclear, because this might be a window into why they don't budge on other issues, they just cannot bring themselves to dig their heels a little bit out of the trench that they've created over the last, you know, 20 years plus.
It is weird, but I think, and this is just the theory, that, you know, the genesis of the environmental movement or the modern environmental movement goes back into the 70s and 60s, where people were really nervous about nuclear power plants and nuclear energy. And, you know, and we saw what happened in Japan, I don't remember how many years ago. So there are occasions for that sort of thing. But for the most part, nuclear energy is quite safe. You know, when I was a little kid, Three Mile Island happened, you know, it was a big deal. And where I grew up on Long Island, actually, there was a power plant they built, I think it was called Shoreham, and they could never open it because, you know, they spent billions, and in the end, they never opened it because the people were scared to live near it. So there's sort of a cultural and like generational fear of nuclear energy. So, and, you know, the nuclear, and, you know, politicians haven't done enough to try to alleviate that fear, I guess. And this is just a theory. I think that's part of it. And the other thing is that there are people on the progressive left, like AOC or others, like real hardcore environmentalists, who I think want, hate capitalism and essentially want to they do. I mean, they call they call it degrowth. I mean, I just think they want us to be weaker economically and to be more socialistic. And this is a perfect, issue and to do it with, because to deal with carbon in the air essentially means you have to take over the entire economy, right? Like everything generates carbon, right? So this is the perfect way for them to do it, the perfect tool. And you can scaremonger and move forward. But I think as every year goes by and the world doesn't fall apart, despite all these warnings, I think it's going to be more and more difficult.
All right, think about this. Many of us spend more time every day in our office chair than in our cars or in our beds. That's why it's so important to invest in the right chair so that you're spending those hours with the right level of support and comfort so that you can get the most productivity out of your day. When you think about it, we do spend so much time worrying about our mattresses and our cars and not our chairs. But X-Chair has made my time at my desk not only more productive, but it's honestly my favorite place to sit for any reason. So not only does X-Chair's patented dynamic variable lumbar, or DVL, offer the ultimate customized support, but my X-Chair can even give me a massage or heat up or cool down. And now, thanks to Relax Chair's new FS360 armrests, I can even adjust my armrests to the perfect position. Now, all these unique X Chair features help the hours at my desk fly by in complete comfort, and that's why I love my X Chair. Go to xchairfederalist.com now. That's the letter X, Chair, FederalistCom, or call 1-844-4X-CHAIR for $100 off your order. X-Chair has a 30-day guarantee of complete comfort, and you can finance your purchase for as little as $30 a month. xchairfederalist.com. Well, and not to sound like Alex Jones, but it's also, carbon is a great example of how you have John Kerry then saying, we can't speak out against China's human rights abuses because we also have to get China on board with the climate agenda, because without China's cooperation, without India's cooperation, there is absolutely no point of putting all of these Americans out of jobs and straining the American economy to do as best as we can and to make the United States' carbon footprint as minimal as is humanly possible in this great global battle against climate change. It means nothing unless you have a sort of global control and cooperation.
I mean, I guess he's right, because if they don't do anything, it really is irrelevant for us to do anything. But that, to me, the lesson is not, hey, let's be nice to China and let them, do what they want. The lesson, I think, is for us to say, we're going to have to adapt to whatever changes climate change brings. And I've argued for a long time, and I believe it's true, that the world has in every quantifiable way gotten better despite the climate change that we've seen, which has been not very, very big. And, I don't mean like for every human being. I just mean in general, for people die from weather, more people are wealthier around the world, or there's less hunger, et cetera. So all their Malthusian predictions have never come true. So I don't really see why we should put ourselves in a position where we allow China essentially to catch up to us, though they have a long way to go. For this cause, it makes no sense, but does show you how, like, and Kerry obviously is someone important in the Democratic Party. I mean, he's had huge, big positions there, and how warped his worldview is on this. And I'm sure he's not alone in that administration.
Yeah, I think that's just, and I don't even know if Alex Jones has ever talked about that. I just meant in the context of like freaking out about globalism. Well, the question of climate control is a really good one in the context of like why you have to have all of these world leaders constantly meeting and flexing their muscles at these events. And it's because they really do want to have this like top-down system, and climate is a good, I think, excuse for them to concentrate powers. And like when you were talking about AOC, it just reminded me of that, because you do need a state if you think you can somehow control the weather via the government. It's like the only way that you're going to do it is put more power in the state.
Think about the insanity of trying to control the weather or climate.
It's great.
I mean, it is crazy. And then, you have Europe, where Spain and Germany tried to go green. They couldn't. Where did Germany go? They go to Russia for oil and gas. And then when Biden, and we have this problem, he's begging OPEC to drill more, then he's begging Venezuela to send us more. I mean, it's insanity, and it never has worked. And thinking about what it means, to me, it has always been the most dangerous authoritarian movement, because they need to control everything to do it. And they need to control your thermostat. They need to control what kind of energy you use. They need to control what car you drive. And this
your appliances, your thermostat, everything. Absolutely everything. Your straws.
Right. Your straws. Right. I mean, and you're much younger than I am, but
your meat.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah. Or your kids don't have as many kids. That is not some fringe idea. Science Magazine had like 11,000 scientists sign a document saying you're having too many kids. For each fewer kid you have, the world is this and that much better off, which is, of course, insane, because some of the densest places on Earth are some of the richest, and some of the most rural are the poorest. So it doesn't really make any sense. But that's a different story.
You were just about to wax nostalgic about your long gone childhood, and I interrupted you.
Well, yeah, but so my long gone childhood, we were worried about the planet freezing over. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah, 70s. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. But then, you know, Al Gore came around and there were agreements. And he had all these warnings. And none of them ever came true. And people, you know, don't talk about this, even though experts said they would. And this continues to happen. So I think that that has been the biggest, you know, the most adversarial thing that's gone on for the environmental movement is no one really trusts them anymore. So when to give up your lifestyle, modernity, basically, for this cause, something bad through weather is going to happen, or climate. Sorry. I know there's a difference. Not exactly sure what. But that something terrible has to happen. And they try to do this every time there's a weather event like we've never had them before. But yet, I think most people realize that it's just simply overdone.
Yeah, I was going to say, I remember you wrote about this in Eurotrash, which is the most aptly named book ever. And it raises the question of Nord Stream 2, which is another just confounding decision from an American president, you know, to make, especially as early in his presidency as Biden did. Could you tell us a little bit more about that example and any other lessons just of policies that have been tried in Europe, climate policies? We don't really even need to look at Europe. We can look at California. But then again, you also look at Texas and you realize what corporate Republicans have also sort of gotten on board with. But are there particular lessons that stand out to you from Europe that, you know, are good parallels as we're going through this insane period of inflation and gas price hikes?
Yeah. I mean, Europe has very highly taxed energy, right? And oil and gas. I think, I don't know what it is now, but when I wrote the book, you know, it was almost like double the price in Germany to drive a car. They drive less, obviously, than we do. But it's super expensive. And I think that that is, it just holds back economic growth. That's money, that extra money is something you'd spend on something else that would grow the economy. They don't have that. I think it's one key reason why they don't really compete with us in any real way. And you know, the price of energy in the United States has been incredibly cheap compared to any other Western country. You know, we're low, like Venezuela low as far as energy prices, you know, in the good old days. But so that helps economic growth. Energy is the lifeblood of the economy. I mean, people can complain about capitalism all they want. We live incredible lives. In fact, I would say that, I mean, this is probably not a popular opinion, but I think that fossil fuel is actually one of the most moral things we have. I think it's saved more lives. I think it has made our lives freer and better in so many ways that we don't think about. Just simply being able to live in and have air conditioning constantly, you know, these are things that most people only a few years back didn't have, right? It makes our lives better. And the travel we do, but not just the travel that we do in the sense of moving around, but getting in our cars and driving anywhere we want. In Europe, that's not something people do. They get on a train and go from A to B. I go anywhere I want whenever I feel like it. And that is an incredible luxury that we have. I don't think people... You know, I went on a long drive recently and you know, and the gas was just really expensive. And it hit me that, you know, for years I could just go and not really think about it. And with these kind of prices, it's something that is no longer a luxury that I can maybe enjoy as often.
Okay, David, we get it. You're fabulously wealthy.
If I was fabulously wealthy, I wouldn't be driving, taking a plane.
You'd have those private jet fuel prices to worry about. Okay, so this is, you said something earlier, you said that you don't really believe that energy independence, which is a very powerful and frequently used cliche in American politics, actually from politicians on both sides of the aisle. Why is it? It's like typical contrarian David Harsanyi fashion. What is it about that cliche of energy independence you think is sort of setting us up with an impossible goal?
Well, I think that people misunderstand what that means, kind of. So, you know, you can produce all your own gas, oil, and bring it in from Canada and just North America, which is probably what we're shooting for more than, you know, North American energy independence. But the problem is that if Saudi Arabia tomorrow stopped production, it wouldn't matter. Our oil would still be more expensive. You can never really cut yourself off when it comes to the energy market from the rest of the world, because it's just not how something like that, you know, a commodity like that works. But still, we would be in control of our own destiny more than we are now with what Biden has done. So it's also, you know, it's also complicated in the sense that if when gas gets below a certain, you know, price per barrel, that big companies don't, it's not worth for them to drill. It's just easier to import. You know what I'm saying? So it's very difficult to be energy independent. I don't want to say we shouldn't, the goal shouldn't be for us to produce our own energy. I'm just saying that we're still going to be, in some sense, you know, in some sense, we're going to have to deal with world events and so on, even if we're producing more.
Yeah. That absolutely makes sense. Now, you also, by the way, this is a great quote that I had forgotten about in your piece, where you say Obama's energy secretary had once claimed that their goal was, quote, boost the price of gasoline to the levels in Europe. That is your point about why reporters aren't asking why Democrats are complaining when it's sort of explicitly been their goal all along. And it gets to this dynamic you were talking about earlier, which is that, you know, should Joe Biden not just be honest about how this is the fulfillment of the Democratic Party's goal? Do you think they are, like, they recognize, or is it just getting to this confusion, I guess, ideological confusion between the establishment and the progressive wing of the Democratic Party? Like, why aren't they just being open about it? Obviously, there are political risks attached to that, but there's nobody saying, like, really, absolutely nobody coming out and saying this is a good thing. It creates or pushes people towards different sources or different methods of transportation. There's absolutely none of that happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird thing because the same thing had happened earlier when Obama was running for president, where he was talking about cutting down drilling, et cetera. And then the prices went up and he re-edited some ads and put in like oil fields like being drilled. Like, they totally changed their message because most Americans don't actually want to pay more for gas, not for climate change, not for anything else. And that's just the reality. I think that the AOC types would be happy to let Americans suffer a bit, but, you know, because they don't really view it that way. They think only corporations will suffer when that is never actually the case. As you see, you know, like Elizabeth Warren saying, oh, the oil companies are gouging, you know, after 20 years, they've decided to all gouge at the same time. First of all, gouging is a good thing sometimes.
Okay, you said sometimes.
Well, most times gouging is necessary. It means that you'll only take what you need rather than, you know, walk, you know, I don't want to get into this, but yeah, my least popular.
Me either.
One of my least popular columns was at the Denver Post. I wrote gouging is good, you know, because I forgot what it was about. But yeah, gouging can be an important part of economically making sure there are no shortages. You know, when something's more expensive, people will take less. But anyway, but you know, this is kind of like just economic illiteracy. And actually, I don't even think she's illiterate. I think she's just dishonest. But you know, you know, so they think the corporations are going to suffer and not people, but people will suffer. And it's not just oil prices aren't just high here. They're high around the world. So, and you know, that has something to do with Ukraine, but it was obviously starting before then as well. It's not, you know, just Putin's war that has done this. And frankly, we should be prepared for something like that. It's bound to happen. There are always things happening in the world that will shake the world economy. And as much as we try to do our own thing, we're always going to be somewhat affected by that, and we should be prepared.
So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure. But as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this. And when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great. And right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza. So you can get buy one, get one free price on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also, the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98 and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotiony feel either. Every set comes with 2 bath towels, 2 hand towels, and 2 washcloths. So you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 1-year limited warranty. Those roll and go anywhere MyPillows. You can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/federalist. Bed sheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/federalist or call 800-794-8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist.
Do you think there's any chance that as these price hikes continue in an election year, Democrats do or make any decision to sort of unleash and actually I think that's kind of a good word. Yeah. American energy sources, is that do you foresee that as a possibility even between now and November?
I mean, Biden has no principles, so maybe. I mean, it just depends what people are telling him to do. I think, you know, didn't he close some leases recently? I think he closed some big leases. So it doesn't look like he's headed in that direction. I think the Democrats are in a tough spot in the sense that obviously they want to do well in the midterms and want to appeal to moderates maybe in some districts, but they also can't risk losing their own side. So, you know, it brings me back to like the last few years of Bush where Republicans gave up on him as well. And then it just craters to really, you know, terrible places for the president. So I think they're a little worried about that. Being that he's in his second year, that's pretty sad, I'd say. But I think that's the reality. I mean, I can't remember a presidency this disastrous at all ever, like early, you know, in the first term. Certainly not in my memory, but certainly even historically, I think it's just one of the worst.
It's good to learn you're a big fan of Donald Trump's first term, David.
I thought it was all right.
It's funny because actually now that I think of it, the press coverage of disaster in the Trump administration, at least early on, was all about palace intrigue. And there's like so little coverage at all of the policy disaster that the Biden presidency has experienced and has been for most people. Now, you have you make a really good point towards the end of the piece. And this is what we take for granted in the entire conversation. It's basically the 30,000 foot point. Economies would collapse, or you say in any event, the upside of fossil fuels, cheap, portable, abundant, far outweighs the negatives of climate change. Economies would collapse without them. And for emerging nations, affordable fossil fuel remains a prerequisite for lifting billions of people out of poverty. And yet here's the president of the United States celebrating the, quote, transition away from affordable energy in the middle of an economic shock. David, to get back to this broader point about the 1870s versus 2022 and about the party that purports to be fighting for the working class and to champion, you know, working people, their policies are completely backwards. But it does seem to be taken for granted that all of the progress that has been made in especially in the private sector and sometimes as a private public partnership has lifted people out of poverty. It has been great for the working class, has been great for public health, and all of the issues of today pale in comparison to what people experience just on a daily basis before some of this technology and fossil fuel energy and all of that stuff really was developed just over the course of the last 100 years. How is it that I think the left misses the forest for the trees on this question? And I know I keep asking you to like mind read Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but you know a lot about this stuff, and it's fun to ask you, you know, like what on earth is going on in their minds.
Well, first I want to go back to the Donald Trump thing we were talking about and just say that I liked his policies.
And the tweets. You liked every tweet.
The tweets were entertaining. The press conferences were awesome. But I, you know, I could have done without that stuff at the end. Just want to make that clear.
So. Yeah, thank you. I'm with you.
Yeah, yeah, like, you know, that that was no good, but the rest was okay. I mean, the funny thing about Donald Trump, and I'll get to the other thing in a second, is that he's literally probably the most moderate Republican in the sense of just like economic policy, for instance. Like he was, you know, he actually moderated the Republican Party in many ways as when it comes to their relationship with big government and government policies and things like that. So it always makes me laugh about they talk like about Trumpism as some sort of radical right wing movement where, you know, he could have been like a moderate Democrat in the 90s, you know what I mean? And run for president with the policies he supported. Anyway.
Yeah, I am completely with you on all of that.
Yeah. I can't get into their minds, but I love how you spoke about the working class. Now, I think that I don't talk about class at all, because I think that if something's good for one part of you know, one section of the American people, it's usually good for all of them. But for sure, the abundant, affordable energy that's been available has been a godsend for people who don't have as much money. I mean, just to get to their jobs, to and the number of jobs and the economic growth fueled by cheap energy is one of the big reasons why we're richer per capita, or, you know, or medium per capita, or any other way you want, than almost any country in the world other than like Monaco. You know what I mean? There's a reason for it, and energy, and we're lucky that we're sitting on it, has something to do with that. And we're lucky that we don't overtax it. And we're lucky that we allow competition in that area. And I think that that's been wonderful for working people. Now, obviously, you know, as the economy changes, it's also poses many challenges for those communities, but just overall, without it, it would be much, much worse. And it's just the reason that socialists are the way they are is because this is sort of a religious belief in the sense that life is unfair and we have to equalize it. And it's always driven those kinds of people. It's always kind of, you know, there are different iterations of that argument. This has sort of a racial component and things like that. But in essence, it's the same thing. You believe that the state can make things fairer for people by compelling and taking and stealing from people who have and giving to people who don't. And it never works. It always, like, let's talk about for a second for the bill that the House passed. I'm not even sure if it was signed by the president, where he gets to price control energy, you know, and companies have to explain why they're charging something. And some bureaucrat's going to decide if that's appropriate or not. Now, I'm not saying that companies never overcharge their consumers, but the idea that in a competitive economy that there is that kind of concerted, you know, effort, or that it's even possible, is ridiculous. And history has shown us, the 20th century has shown us, that price controls are disastrous, and yet they go right back to it. Because, I don't know, maybe voters like to hear it. I don't know. This is why, you know, I don't have much trust in voters either.
Well, yeah, David literally wrote a book against democracy, which, by the way, it's a correct argument, but it's a bold one.
Yeah, I love when people like sometimes like this you, and then they have like the cover of me working against democracy, like on Twitter. And I'm like, yeah, no one bought that book. Like, thank you.
That the market has spoken, David.
the market is not primed for an anti-democracy book for some reason. I don't know why.
I wonder. No. That's I think also there's this, whatever Democrats say, the idea that the Democratic Party is going to implement some sort of just, or the Republican Party is going to implement some sort of just system of price controls that's not just cronyism is absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, that's what always happens. And it would happen here, too. I mean, I'm not a populist, as you know, so I have this debate all the time. But my thing with the capitalism we do have is not that we have too much of it. It's that it's too connected to big business. I mean, and yes, that is a political problem, right? It's the politicians who make those deals. It's the politicians who hand out those favors. I mean, I would let all these companies deal with the world in their, you know, by themselves. I mean, I think if anyone builds a monopoly, obviously I'd want to break that up, a true monopoly. But that is rarely the case when you actually let a market work. You know what I mean? So my problem is the cronyism, absolutely. And oil companies are part of that. But the green sector is the biggest, most cronyistic, you know, industry in America, probably, other than maybe the tech industry or something.
Well, yeah. And then you have the green industry sort of trying to, or you have the oil industry flirting with the green industry, and then you have a Texas situation where they were over reliant on renewables, and Republicans were part of it too. Wherever the money is, you'll see both political parties.
Yeah, I mean, in small ways, I'll just give you an example. Everyone's got like, or used to where I lived before this place, which I'm not going to tell you where it is. I almost gave my address away. They used to put, everyone had solar panels, right? But it was all paid for by me. And I just wouldn't allow them to put it up there, even though it was for free, right? So that's one thing. Or look at electric cars. I see everyone driving Teslas around. I mean, you know how much they would cost without government help and subsidies? They'd be unaffordable for any normal human being. But I see other companies are making giant bets on electric cars because they know that the government is going to in some way mandate or subsidize that industry. I have no problem with someone buying an electric car. I do have a problem with them buying it on my dime or your dime. And that's really what's been going on.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And we've seen it play out, which is why some of these arguments are so ridiculous. And what your piece was, I think, so helpful at highlighting is like this experiment has run over the last 15 years and it's failed. And so we should be making better decisions at this point. But don't hold your breath for that. David Harsanyi, senior editor at The Federalist. Welcome back to the podcast. And thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Well, you've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.